The Guardian.
Hello everybody and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today the Champions League, Liverpool demolish Roma and then give them faint hope just at the end. Is asking whether Mo Salah is the best footballer in the world at this exact moment, the best conversation in the world at this exact moment. In Munich, Bayern somehow contrived to lose to Real in a weirdly bad game of football. We'll look ahead to Arsene Wenger's final European game at the Emirates, his final home game against Spanish opposition, his final game as manager in London on a Thursday, and the last time he'll pit his Gunners team against a man called Diego until next week. Also, the Football League, including Leeds' exciting jaunt to Myanmar, will take your questions. Feedback Corner, that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Paolo Bandini, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, a little tired. Been a busy week, but good.
Okay, excellent. Philippe Auclair.
Good morning to you.
Lovely to see you. Are you well?
I'm not too bad. Thank you very much.
Hi, Barry.
Hello.
Huge reaction to the last pod after, obviously, we didn't ask what Lars had for breakfast. It was brown rice with chili sauce with a fried egg on top. Also, Barry, the most comments I think we've ever had below the line on the Guardian website. Dieter says, great bitchy handbags between Barry and Barney. They should just wrestle naked in mud in front of a live audience.
That's not going to happen.
Okay. Okay, let's start on the pitch at Anfield. We'll get on to what happened off the pitch in a bit. Liverpool 5, Roma 2. Philippe, did you enjoy this?
Very much so. I'm not saying that I understood necessarily all that was happening. Like, for example, why is it that for 20 minutes Roma looked quite wonderful and Liverpool looked really quite scared and couldn't get their rhythm going? And then suddenly, as soon as this goal gets in, that's it. Completely different. Maybe it's a witch's curse again. Maybe it's psychological. I don't know. Maybe it's Roma. You know, they've got this thing about Europe. And despite what happened against Barcelona. No, it was absolutely... It was insane, chaotic. I think loads of questions have got to be asked of Roma's quite suicidal tactics. It's not as if, you know, it's something you say in hindsight. I think before the game, when we saw how they were lining up, we thought, we've seen Liverpool against three at the back. Usually it works okay. Mm-hmm. And still they did that. Not only that, they played so high, such a high line. And with, you know, Fazio, for example, against Sadio Mane, that's not exactly going to happen, is it? So a bizarre game, to be honest, but absolutely thrilling. And who knows what's going to happen next week in the Stadio Olimpico.
Well, you know, when you say it was not being able to understand why the sort of game broke down to those parts, I think exactly because of the tactics. I mean, what Roma did against Barcelona, who were effectively playing a variation of 4-4-2, made a lot of sense if they could do what they did do in the second leg, which is really sort of win the fight on the flanks. With Kolarov and Florenzi forcing the two wingers back, what you ended up with, and, you know, I think Jonathan Wilson actually wrote about this, but it completely... What defined that tie is that you had three against two then for Roma at the back. They had, you know, their three defenders against the two attackers who were left up there. They had three against two in the middle as well because they pushed back the wingers. And so they were able to just completely swamp them. Against Liverpool playing a 4-3-3, that doesn't happen. You've got three against three in both departments, effectively. And you basically rely on... Absolutely, especially at the back, you are absolutely reliant on winning your individual battles. You have said for every player, we're just going one-on-one, which when it worked, and look, Roma's midfield can be very sort of impressive in its muscularity and its physicality, the ability on top of you. De Rossi, Strootman, Nainggolan, they're all good players. And I think at that period of 20-odd minutes, that's what was happening. They were just winning the individual fights in the middle of the park, and they were getting forward with it. Obviously, Kolarov hit the bar, and maybe, who knows, if Kolarov's shot goes in, and it wasn't by much, because Karius didn't really seem to know an awful lot about it, even though he did get a little bit of a touch on it. Maybe the game goes differently. But the idea that you're going to get away with that for 90 minutes of Fazio, Manolas, and Jesus lining up against Mane, Firmino, and Salah is bonkers to me. It's bonkers. And, you know, actually, Manolas sort of had this pre-game press conference where he was asked about how fast Salah was, and he was like, oh, I'm pretty fast too. And I'm like, oh, it's a nice line, but you're not. Like, you're nowhere near as fast as Salah is. You're nowhere near as fast as Mane is. And as soon as Liverpool sort of clocked that all they needed to do was bypass the midfield, that was it. And Roma completely failed to adjust to it.
But what is incomprehensible, though, is how they failed to adjust to that, because that was so obvious that even Glenn Hoddle, I think, realised what was going on.
Well, Rio Ferdinand, Barry, said it's as if the Roma, you know, management hadn't watched Liverpool once this season.
Yes, I'm guessing they must have. It's conceivable they haven't. But you know, we had this with Leicester. You know, week after week after week, Leicester were winning the same way. Teams who had clearly seen them play were lining up and making it easy for them to win the year they won the title, I'm referring to, obviously. So, yeah, I'm guessing he can't conceivably not have seen Liverpool play this season or studied videos, but clearly he thought he knew better and he'd learnt a very harsh lesson, because if Sadio Mane had had his eye in, you know, let's not forget he missed two very good chances and
within
had a goal ruled out for
49 seconds of each other, the two chances, unbelievable.
Yeah, and then had one ruled out for offside. That was before Liverpool even got off the mark. So
Mo Salah's been directly involved in 56 goals across all competitions this season. He's scored 43. I think Ian Rush's season record for Liverpool is 47.
In a league with 22 teams.
That's a fair point. Even still.
But quite a few less European matches, I would imagine.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Number of games they played aside, this is an extraordinary player on extraordinary form. I don't know how fascinating the who's the best player in the world right now conversation is, but he's in the conversation.
He's in the conversation. I'm like everybody else. I almost can't understand. I'm saying I can't understand. I don't know. Is it something that has he suddenly found the key to this extraordinary room in which everything is beautiful? And but will he leave it at some point, or is it just that he is that good and we simply hadn't seen it? Well, Paolo, I don't know. I mean, at Fiorentina and Roma, when you talk to people who saw him there, they said, yes, he was good. He was excellent. He was a terrific player for us, but we had no idea he could possibly reach that kind of level. And especially the way that he seems now to be able to, when he has a chance, to put it in the net, when usually it took him about three tries before this happened. I mean, that's an extraordinary transformation at the age of 25, which is rather late, by the way, in a player's career. And I'm trying to think of other players who suddenly had this explosion, as we would say in French. And I can't find anything which is comparable to that at this stage in his career.
I can think of a few cyclists and long-distance runners.
Yes, certainly.
I'm genuinely not suggesting anything. It's just cropped into my head or popped into my head. I can think of, you know, if he was a cyclist or a long distance runner, people would be asking questions. I don't think there's any questions to be asked there.
No, none.
I'm surprised it hasn't been raised before.
But you put it in my mind now when it wasn't there.
You know, I don't think you could, like, there are players who you could point to who've had sort of goal scoring explosions later in their career. I mean, Luca Toni is a prime example of someone who really sort of hit his very best form. He had some okay seasons in lower divisions, but really had his peak form late.
Ricky Lambert.
In terms of, did people think he was a good player in Italy? Plainly, and he had a very good last season at Roma. It's what sort of as a sort of fascinating sort of statistical pointer for me in the run up to this game was that before kickoff, Salah had 41 goals, and funnily enough, he hadn't hit that quite those heights himself at Roma, but he had helped Edin Dzeko to get to 39 goals last season, and he was the assist man last season. He was the guy who was always teeing Dzeko up, huge part of why Dzeko got that number. So I don't think people underestimated him, but yeah, he left for €42 million, and at the time people at Roma thought, that's okay business. Now, I would say that transfer happened before the Neymar transfer, and the Neymar transfer just fundamentally redefined what we thought were appropriate transfer fees for people. I think that if you sort of drew a line before that and looked at all transfer fees, the amount that Liverpool spent wouldn't seem out of whack. It would seem about right. It's just that we now have a completely different perception again.
I think we can actually even put our hands up, because I think most people, when the transfer happened, thought that's rather a lot of money for somebody who was a failure at Chelsea.
Yeah,
we have to remember
that. I don't think that was the case in Italy. I think that
was the case in England.
Yeah, and I think people maybe need to get over that, because, you know, Kevin De Bruyne as well. There's some evidence that people don't always get that decision right, and it's not just Chelsea who make wrong calls on players either over time. But I do think he's obviously continue to evolve as a player. I think it's we should say, by the way, because we've talked about his speed and getting in behind that defence. The first goal wasn't about getting in behind at all. It was about putting the ball in the absolute top corner of the top corner. It was just a beautiful
just amazing, finish. Wasn't it?
But I do think it's also true that he has arrived at a team and a project that suits him to the ground. I mean, Jurgen Klopp is the right manager for him. He is a manager who has built a whole system around speed and fast breaking, and Mohamed Salah is really fast and really good at exploiting those fast breaks. I think there's a lot of elements to it, but I do think that one of those elements certainly is the right manager.
It's also a perfect storm because psychologically he's on a high as well because of what he's achieved with Egypt and the role he's played in Egypt's qualification, so which showed that he had nerves of steel and all the rest of it. The fact that he's partnered by one of the most wonderfully selfless strikers on the planet, i.e. Roberto Firmino, who is having, you could say the same thing, Firmino is absolutely having a huge, huge influence. And it's a beautiful footballer and complete footballer who is quite happy to leave the space to Salah in more ways than one, because he does a bit what the old false nines used to do. Let's say, I don't know, actually, Barcelona used to do that, to have a false nine like that. And he's quite happy for, he's creating the space, he's scoring himself, he's giving the, he's dropping back, he's finding those, he's opening these corridors in which Salah can go full tilt and use his speed and his pace and his finishing capacity. So, yeah, it's a kind of perfect a fusion of so many wonderful things.
I think Firmino's like, it's ridiculous how, I mean, obviously because Salah is playing at such a level, that's who we talk about most. But Firmino has scored 10 goals in the Champions League this season, which is second, you know, joint with Salah, second only to Ronaldo. And he's got 6 assists as well. And, you know, he's sort of
barely mentioned.
Exactly, because of Salah. Right.
Ian Rush, 32 goals in 41 league games, 10 in 14 domestic cups, 5 in 10 in Europe. Salah, 31 in 33 in the league, 1 in 1 in cups, 11 in 13 in Europe. Question is how long Salah goes and also where he does it.
Well, I agree with Philippe. The stars seem to have aligned perfectly for him. Everything's going wonderfully. But then the next step for players who do exceptionally well at Liverpool is generally to go up a level to, well, Liverpool fans would disagree, but, you know, to go to Real or Barca. And if he does that, will he be played in the same way? Will his next manager bring the best out of him? My instinct would be no, but, you know, who knows? The only way we'll find out is if it happens.
Firmino, the player who has needed the fewest matches, 11, to score his first 10 goals in the entire history of the Champions League, which is when European football began. Roma got 2 late goals, Paolo. Mm-hmm. How much hope have they been given?
Certainly, Di Francesco, the manager, is talking it up and saying we've got a chance. The Italian press, I think, with some justification, are saying, well, after we saw not only Roma do it, but also Juventus come within such a, you know, a narrow margin of doing it against Real Madrid, we can't say it's impossible. I would say that I suppose you could call this more comparable as a first leg to what happened to Juventus against Madrid, where it really did feel like in the first leg there was a gulf. To compare this to Roma's first leg against Barcelona, for me, is a false comparison, because Roma were really good in that first leg against Barcelona. They lost 4-1, which was a really misleading scoreline, but they played well. Here, frankly, I thought they were absolutely blown away in the middle part of the game, and they stole a couple of goals at the end when Salah had gone off and Liverpool dropped their concentration a bit. I think, of course, what that reminds us, and which isn't news to anyone, I guess, is that Liverpool can be got at. So can Roma score 3 goals against them? Yeah, I think that's conceivable. Why not? If they can score 2 at Anfield, why can't they score 3 at the Stadio Olimpico? But it's going to take a drastically different game. It's going to take a drastically different plan from Di Francesco. And it's going to take, I don't know, I find it hard to imagine on the basis of the 90 minutes of football that I saw in Liverpool. But if there has ever been a season to make me doubt that these things can be overturned, this is the season.
And it would be the most ridiculous way to get through a Champions League quarterfinal and semi-final, wouldn't it?
You know, you're a red card away from this kind of thing. You should never forget that. That can happen. I saw that happen when it's a game I keep talking about. When Fulham beat Juve 4-1 at Craven Cottage, nobody gave them a chance before that game. But Cannavaro, I think,
was
sent off. And then they scored the four goals they needed.
Do Roma have a Clint Dempsey who can score a chip like that?
Yes, they do.
And Roma also haven't conceded at home yet.
Yes.
In the Champions League this season.
And they've played some decent sides as well, haven't they? Chelsea, Atletico, Barcelona. Richard asks, how do England fill the gap in central midfield now, given the injury to Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain? And it's a real shame that he's out of the rest of the Liverpool season and out of the World Cup. I think, Barry, no one at the start of the season would have said, how will England cope without Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain in midfield? It's a sort of sign of what he's done at Liverpool.
Well, I mean, he's improved hugely since leaving Arsenal. It's been cited as a poor reflection on Arsene Wenger's coaching abilities. Maybe that may be true, and maybe he was just stagnating there. But he will be missed by England. And
you don't really see any others with his profile. That's the thing. I mean, he's very direct. He's got a very good shot. And you look around in that England squad, you said doing very well for Liverpool, but also doing very well for England, actually, in the friendlies. He was also he was terrific in those games. And you need, as well with the kind of system that Southgate wants to use, you want one of those really, these players who are going to be able to carry the ball directly from box to box. And he's one of those. And there aren't many around.
And a lot of people are talking about James Milner. I don't know.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he's continually being underrated as a footballer.
Mm-hmm. He's excellent against Roma.
He's got the most assists in the Champions League.
So it's just a question of a phone call from Mr. Southgate to Mr. Milner saying, your retirement, forget about it, you're in.
Mm. From what I understand, and I can't remember who was telling me this, Southgate has spoken to Milner before and has not got anywhere yet.
Right.
You wonder how this will... wonder if he can change his mind at this stage. I guess if you say you're going to start, you can't make that guarantee. But it does. It's a shame for England.
I mean, better midfielders, English midfielders in England at the moment.
Look, there are calls for Shelvey, aren't there?
Yep.
And you'd put him in. I mean, when Livermore got in the squad, that was people were saying, look, Livermore's not had a brilliant season. He doesn't unlock defences like Shelvey can. But Shelvey doesn't have the drive of Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Nope.
Then I'd say Milner doesn't either. Look, we should talk about what happened off the pitch. A terrible story. 53-year-old Sean Cox in a critical condition in hospital following an attack outside Anfield before the game. It's in a pub, wasn't it?
Outside a pub.
Awful story off the pitch. 53-year-old Sean Cox in a critical condition in hospital following an attack outside a pub. Before the game, two men from Rome, aged 20, 29, have been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder. Seven others being held for various offences at Tuesday's match. Roma have condemned it in a statement saying, look, the strongest possible terms, the abhorrent behaviour of a small minority of travelling fans who brought shame on the club and the vast majority of Roma's well-behaved supporters. A club spokesman said there was no place for this type of vile behaviour in football. It was cooperating with the authorities. UEFA said they were deeply shocked, called it vile, and are waiting to receive full reports before deciding on potential disciplinary charges. There's history with Roma.
Well, there's
fans.
A couple of things there. First of all, I think Liverpool fans are cross with Roma because Roma referred to them as clashes, and it was, by all accounts, an unprovoked attack. And this Irishman wasn't, involved, but just a more or less an innocent bystander. And second of all, for UEFA to say they're shocked that Roma fans are misbehaving is quite odd, because they've, a list of form as long as your arm for incidents like this. They're far from alone in, having fans who misbehave. And, I saw the response under Roma's statement from a lot of Liverpool fans who were being very sanctimonious, and we shouldn't forget that they're fans of... or some of the Liverpool fans occasionally misbehave as well on their travels, as do fans of lots of clubs. Having said all that, I'm not really sure how you can avoid this kind of thing unless you ban travelling fans.
Yeah, it's clearly a problem that Roma and indeed Lazio and indeed lots of other Italian clubs, but I think that there has been, even within Italy, probably a particularly high rate of incidents in Rome, those two groups of fans, that the authorities have struggled to come to terms with for a long time. And it's, you know, it's extremely layered. We could do a whole podcast about ultra culture and what goes into it. I thought Gab Marcotti had a nice bit in the Times this morning trying to explain it a little bit. The sort of breakdown that you have between ultra groups that are sort of quite ideological. There's quite a hierarchy on the Kurva in the stands. There's quite, you know, sort of firm affiliation in some parts to groups which will have perhaps political leanings or perhaps some other ideological leaning that brings them together. But then you also have what in Italy are often referred to as the canisciolti, which is, you know, the stray dogs, who are the guys who are just there and are unaffiliated and are a little bit the sort of hardest for the authorities to deal with for that reason, because there's no sort of structure to it. And I don't know, because we don't know, because we don't have the details of this particular group that did that yet, but it's certainly a working theory that this is who these guys were the guys who were not even sort of affiliated to one specific group. They're just the ones who are there who are nutters, for want of a better word, who want to go and cause mayhem and do this. And of course, I think it was probably would be fair to say that there are more things that you could be doing on a sort of systematic level to identify these people, to stop them from traveling. I think there have been, again, so many instances with Roma that it is something you can't take away. You can't sort of separate that connection from the fact that Roma are going places or teams are coming to Roma and these things keep happening. But in a sort of big metropolitan city, to sort of find the individuals who are doing this is also not straightforward. And, you know, I have some sympathy for James Pallotta, the Roma owner, who hates this and would love to sort of click his fingers and stop it and hasn't been able to do it. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean in the meantime that we shouldn't be doing more to put, frankly, the lives and safety of other people ahead of his club. The most important thing for anybody going to a football game should be the idea that you can go to a football game and enjoy yourself and not wind up the night in hospital. I mean, it's horrible. It's a horrible thought that you just are going there to enjoy your night and watch your team play what turned out to be a magnificent game, and instead this guy's life is at risk. It's beyond heartbreaking, and I you know, I wish I could say I have some great solution for it beyond what's been said, just ban fans from traveling altogether. But then that, you know, limits the many fans. I'm not even talking about Roma fans here. I mean, that's talking about every club. The many, many fans who likewise want to travel and follow their team and support them. I don't know. It's a horrible, complicated situation. But, you know, the number one thing is just thoughts with Sean and his family, because it's awful.
Mm. If you were a Liverpool fan, would you go?
I'd make sure where the security arrangements are. Hmm. Because they're bound to be incidents.
I mean, they certainly, the sort of initial word is they're going to expand the usual area around the stadium where they're going to ban alcohol from being sold. So presumably that incorporates bars being stopped from selling alcohol, create a big thing. They're going to advise Liverpool fans on safe places to be. I would say that from my trips to Rome to watch games there, I think that there are certainly areas where you are more or less likely to find trouble. But equally, again, it's a huge city. So Liverpool nor anyone else can they're not, no one can guarantee you that you won't walk into the bar which a group of idiots decide to come after.
I mean, you're not going to go for a drink around the Stadio Olimpico, because there's bugger all there. So you're going to be in center of town, you're going to be near the Colosseum, or you're going to be in Trastevere or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are, you know, these little kiosks, the sort of little sort of stands almost, which, you know, during the regular week people would go to get their coffee, which sell beer, which on match days that all my fans tend to congregate at. There are some particular places like that that you would say, okay, don't approach the stadium from this way if you want to avoid the big crowd of all my fans. But this is almost the thing. In many ways, the areas where there's lots of Roma fans are probably not even the ones where you're likely to get trouble, because that's where the police are going to be. The place where you're going to find trouble is going to be the place that no one's looking, because even though these guys don't actually seem to have been very smart about the, smart is a horrible word to use, I don't know how to put it, but like, they don't seem to have thought much about whether or not they're going to do something in view and get seen by police. Here, a lot of the time when things have happened in Rome, it has been away from police. They're not going to go and start the fight right in front of the riot police. They're going to do it somewhere where they think the police aren't watching them. It's very, very complicated. I think that the vast majority of Liverpool fans well, I don't want to say this because who knows, but the vast majority of fans who go to games in Rome don't get stabbed. It's still, you know, in numbers terms, that's the reality. Thousands of fans go there every year and watch football games and go home fine. But can you be guaranteed that you won't be the one who does? No, because it's happened. It's happened time and again. And I can't sort of sit here and say that it won't happen again because I have no authority or ability to predict that.
That'll do for part one. In part two, we will start with Bayern versus Real. Welcome to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Hey, we're doing a live show in Copenhagen on May the 10th. Jonathan Wilson, Barney Ronay, Barry Glendening on the same day as the Danish Cup final, Fredericia's fairy tale, run to the semi-finals of the Danish Cup is over. They were beaten 1-0 by Silkeborg last night. The only goal of the game, an own goal by their left-back, Oliver Fredsted. Right. Bayern Munich 1, Real Madrid 2. This was a game that, Barry, that they shouldn't have won, but yet they did win. I didn't think it was a very good game of football. I don't know if you agree.
I thought it was a very entertaining game after a while. It started badly. But the quality of football, it looked like some of them were drunk, maybe, or had their boots on the wrong feet. There were some scintillating moments of skill. There's a gif going around about of a Marcelo trap.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Just incredible. But, yeah, some of the you know, it didn't look like two of the finest teams in Europe playing each other. It looked like two pub teams just going at it.
It's sort of two old boxers slugging out, you know, people just getting injured, you know, in a sort of pub football type way. Someone always pulls a hamstring in the 8th minute and then someone else has to wander off after half an hour and I haven't got any subs left. Matt says, did Marcelo really trap the ball like that, or was it a glitch in the broadcast? Is there a scam with Madrid and magnetic boots?
Bayern Munich,
I find it extraordinary that people start thinking this an important thing, that it's something worth mentioning, that it's all about an individual piece of skill. That's rubbish.
Do you agree? I mean, I pay to watch Berbatov control
his goal kick. I've seen Özil do that against CSKA Moscow the other day. I've seen plenty of players do that, and it's wonderful. It's wonderfully skillful. Is that the only thing that is worth remembering about the game? Perhaps, actually. Because
I don't think anyone is saying that. I'm just pointing it out as an example of a sublime piece of skill in a game that was pretty lacking in sublime pieces of skill.
Yeah.
An interesting thing about Bayern's goal last night, which I don't think was picked up on over here, but someone emailed me from Norway to point out that the reason Marcelo was out of position when Bayern scored was because he'd gone off to get the ball to give back for a goal kick, and the ball boys were quicker than him, so by the time he got back in the pitch, the ball was halfway up the field and he was caught out of position.
Well, it was interesting, wasn't it? Because, of course, he had the other, more game-changing moment of skill was that first goal, which was an exceptionally good strike.
That is. Yeah, it was fantastic.
So he sort of, was in many ways the defining actor in that first half, because he was missing when Kimmich came forward and scored the goal for Bayern, but then he made up for it.
But Keylor Navas, I mean, I don't know what he's doing for that first goal.
Yeah, I don't know either. But to be honest, this was a game, it was bit like a, I don't know, mess of porridge or something, with some absolutely magnificent talents. And in terms of play, what was there? I mean, this Real Madrid team is bizarre, because it might well win the European Cup, but it is quite ugly to watch. I mean, it's amazing to say that of a team which has got players like Marcelo is wonderful, Luka Modric, Sergio Ramos, Toni Kroos, Cristiano Ronaldo, Isco, Asensio. You would think, my goodness, this will be champagne or cava football. And it's not. It's actually pretty dour. And they were I think, very lucky to be against a Bayern Munich team. I cannot remember Lewandowski having a worse game in front of goal as this one. And a Bayern Munich team as well, which was devoid of a number. I mean, we should remember that. A number of very important players.
Yeah, Kieran
says. Some of whom might be back for the second leg. And I'm not putting it beyond Bayern to do something in the return leg. Because I think they've shown that they can unbalance that Real Madrid team.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened last year. They lost at home and went to Madrid and won, and then lost in extra time. But they lost in extra time after having Vidal sent off, which was a travesty, and with two of Madrid's goals being should have been disallowed. So they are more than capable of doing it. Plus, there's the added blueprint now of Juventus went there and absolutely thumped them in terms of the on the night performance. So I agree that I don't think this Real Madrid team looks all that hot for a team with so many fabulous players in it. I think they definitely can be got at.
In which case, do you give more credit to Zidane? Eddington says, is Zidane the opposite of a bald fraud, a hairy real deal?
He's certainly not hairy. Yeah, I mean, the tactics last night were weird. I think Real just were happy to contain Bayern and, you know, take them back to the Bernabeu, beat them there, but probably couldn't believe their luck because they were having quite a bad night at the office in Bayern Munich. Had an even worse one, you know. So it was a strange game, but I did enjoy it despite the lack of quality. I think it gives the rest of us heart when you see all these brilliant footballers just making so many mistakes and playing so badly.
But is there part of it that we often forget that when a team is playing, they're playing against a team trying to stop them? I mean, there is that, that the both these sides have lots of good players, even if, you know, as you pointed out and Kieran pointed out, that Bayern were missing their goalkeeper, their left-back, a centre-back, their holding midfielder, that, you know, Robin went off as well early.
And Kingsley Coman as well.
And Kingsley Coman, yeah. So if you're playing, if you're good, but you're playing against good players, they might be stopping them. I take your point, Barry. It did look like they were all being useless. But
at one point, Thiago Alcantara, who is a magnificent footballer, tried to pass the ball to his left-back. There was not a Real Madrid player within 15 yards, and the pass went about 6 yards behind his teammate straight into touch. That's the kind of game it was.
Yeah, Marcelo had one, didn't he, where he tried a channel ball and just lumped out of play, and Ronaldo had a shot that went out for a throw. So yeah, you're right.
No, it was quite extraordinary, but in a way it's a bit what we said after the PSG game. Do you remember when we eviscerated Real Madrid and PSG for what we had seen? And it was very much the same kind of performance. So somewhere, somehow, Real Madrid has this knack of pulling results out of performances which, to be honest, are not fantastic. Actually, even below par. It's odd. Very odd.
The funny thing is just, I guess, that typically we attribute that knack to a certain individual. Because Ronaldo, I think, had scored in 11 consecutive Champions League games before this one. But I guess it was just a reminder that even when he doesn't do it, there are other players who can still decide games even when they're not playing well.
Can we not credit him for that overhead kick fake? He pretended to do an overhead kick. The Bayern Munich defence stopped, and then Marcelo put it in.
He did. His goal that was disallowed was another very nice finish. I mean, it was a handball, but it was a very nice finish.
All right. Tonight, Arsenal play Atletico Madrid. Arsene Wenger, in a press conference, said the timing wasn't really his decision, and then came out with a statement saying, I want to clear up that the timing of the announcement was right. So I was happy for the club to decide when we announced it. So it sounded like he was saying he was pushed, and then he was saying I wasn't really pushed.
Are the two statements contradictory if you look at them a bit more closely?
Or are they not?
I don't think they are.
Okay. You traced me, Philippe.
The timing was right, but it was not his choice. Mm-hmm. That's not contradictory. It can happen. I mean, for me, and I think for most people who were at this extraordinary press conference after the win last Sunday, yeah. It was quite clear that we had a very angry man in front of us, that he didn't intend to go, that he wouldn't have chosen to go that way, that it was basically the silver pistol and whiskey situation, that he had to take the decision and to make that statement, because otherwise somebody else would make it for him at some point. So no, it's I don't think the two statements are mutually exclusive.
Okay. Diego Costa's in the Atletico squad, despite Simeone saying at the weekend he had no chance of being fit for the game at the Emirates because of hamstring injury. He's missed three games since limping out of the quarterfinal second leg. That changes how Atletico approach it.
Yes, and that changes also, I mean, one of the reasons is because Griezmann, who is clearly, you know, the super player in that team, plays much, much, much better when he's got somebody alongside him up front. And with Costa, it's a bit of a frightening proposition for an Arsenal team which is not at full. And I haven't seen, I must say, the team news, but is Mkhitaryan, there was a chance that he might be available for tonight, which would make a big difference. I'm not sure if we have the news or not on that, but they are missing quite a few players.
Well, in 2014, Diego Costa was rushed back from a hamstring injury to play in the Champions League final against Real Madrid, and it backfired spectacularly because he had to be taken off after 10 minutes, and now there seems to be a danger of history repeating itself. That's all, but maybe one start, he might just be on the bench.
Arsenal's eighth European semi-final. They've progressed from six of the previous seven, which is impressive.
It's certainly more impressive than Spurs' semi-final record.
There's no witch's curse. They only failed to reach the final in 2008-2009, the Champions League. Then they lost to Manchester United. Josh says, if Arsenal fans still don't show up or boo despite winning tonight, should Arsene Wenger pull a Mick McCarthy and just leave now?
They're going to show up and they're not going to boo. Where's they decided they're going to boo? Of course they're not going to boo. And they're going to show up. I think that...
Well, what if they lose?
I still don't think they're going to... Well, it depends how you lose. But if the performance is akin to what we've seen at home, be it in the Europa League or in the league, I can't see any reason why they should boo. And perhaps as well people will have reflected on what happened in the last game, where, to be honest, nobody knew exactly on which foot to dance, as we say in French. Is that... You didn't know quite how to approach the game as a fan because that's a long, drawn goodbye. And tonight's a bit different. It's, you know, first of all, the European
Well, the game
nights,
matters, doesn't
the,
it?
The game matters an awful lot. It's a European night. It's under floodlights. And the circumstances are completely different. Arsenal will also be the underdog against Atletico de Madrid, which is quite logical. So, no, I can't see any of that happening.
I know, just, you know... Probably this will tempt fate in some way, but I know we've talked about Arsenal's home and away form. Atletico have been very uneven in the way they've played lately. They've got, I think they've lost four of the last six away from home, draw another one. They've only got one win in that time, so they're not a team that, you know, the way this is set up as a tie is very much you've got to do your business at home. So if Arsenal were to lose, it'd be very bad news.
Jim says, why does Philippe not rate Luis Enrique as Arsenal manager? Who would he want?
It's not a question. First of all, I don't rate him as a manager. I'm just saying I don't think he's the right fit. I think for some reason people tend to forget also what he's done in his career, because what did he do? He was the Barca B manager. Then he went to Roma, where Paolo will confirm it didn't work out well at all. He went to Celta de Vigo, whom he took to a place mid-table, I think ninth or something like that, which is okay, but it was not great. When he took over at Barcelona, he had huge problems with Leo Messi, certainly in the first season. And there was even an element of the Barca support who said that they were winning despite Henry Kane, not because of him, because the tension was so high. So all of this, and he won the Champions League, fine, beautiful, wonderful, and then left, but also after presiding over one of Barca's worst ever European nights, which everybody forgot about because of remontada, but against PSG, they were a shambles. And I'm thinking, are we talking here about the manager for Arsenal after the departure of Arsene Wenger? I'm thinking, well, perhaps not. That's all there is. I think he's oversold. I think he's presented like being a solution, one of those great European coaches. I think he's still yet to prove it.
I think I find him very hard to judge for a lot of the reasons you've just outlined. The Roma situation is interesting. In sort of simple factual terms, that they finished seventh that year, which is the lowest finish they've had still since like 2005. So it was a bad season.
They also went out to Slovan Bratislava in the UEFA Cup.
Yep. What I remember that team in that season was a lot of possession and a real sort of stodginess in the final third and a bit of inability to cut through teams, which I suppose, you know, you go to Barcelona and you have players like Messi and it becomes a lot easier if you can sort of keep the ball to just trust them to make the difference. I guess what would appeal to some people about him and what I can see from Arsenal's point of view is he's a very intense manager. Interestingly, a lot of the Roma players who worked under him, De Rossi, absolutely effusive in his praise for him, despite the way things went. Like he says that he was someone who came in and really sort of changed the culture, told players that no one was going to get special treatment, everyone was going to have to be treated exactly the same. And some players really appreciated that. And I think that as a short-term fix, I can certainly see the concept behind it for us. And I don't think you would ever view him as a long-term manager. I think that his own sort of way he talks about management, he's furiously intense in what he does and he burns himself out and has to stop, which is what happened at Barcelona. But interestingly, that Messi situation, which is really sort of fascinating to me to look at with hindsight. So there was a point where Messi literally said in an interview, "I've always thought I'll finish my career at Barcelona, but things don't always go as you want them to." It got to that point where we thought that Messi was going to leave Barcelona because of how not well they were getting on. And then they went on and won the Champions League together and had this fantastic season. I think he's someone who will create real tension within a squad. And I can see that there would be a case to make right now that is what Arsenal have been lacking. That Arsenal have been allowed to get into a mindset where this is just okay, and you bring in someone who makes nothing okay is perhaps a short-term thing that Arsenal want. I don't know if I know that he wouldn't be my first choice for the role, but I'm just sort of trying to outline, I guess, why there could be a case for him, even though I share a lot of Philippe's reservations about has he proven that at a club that isn't set up to win as much as Barcelona were, he actually can do it.
Okay.
Who would be your first choice, Pam?
I have really talked myself into, in the last few days, Jardim. I think that he has earned it. I think he has gone one step at a time, always succeeding, always moving up to better clubs, always developing players, showing that he is a man manager who can actually bring individual talent on, as well as older players like Falcao, sort of bringing him back to what he's capable of. I think he is a manager who just has shown that he deserves the chance to manage a club of that stature. I mean, no, not that he isn't managing a great club now in Monaco, but... and indeed might be taking a step out of the Champions League to do it if he went to Arsenal, but he certainly would be dealing with greater resources at Arsenal.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I would take a punt on Mikel Arteta.
Would you?
Yeah.
Why?
Okay.
Well, I think you're kind of getting... I'd certainly give him an interview, see how he presents himself. I imagine he would present himself very well. And I'd take a punt on him personally, see how he gets on, give him 2 years, and if it's not working out, get rid, give it Baldy. But following Wenger, it's not like following Sir Alex Ferguson.
Yeah.
So I think you've got margin to fail a bit for a while.
And Wenger won't be in the stands, just there, yeah, for the cameras,
glowering.
I'd give it John Beck. Anyway, the other semi-final, Marseille versus Salzburg. We'll round those up on Monday. Other game, Marseille-Salzburg. Is this a huge moment for Marseille, Philippe?
Absolutely. First chance to be in a European final since 2004, when Didier Drogba was terrifying absolutely everybody in Europe, in European football, and they're a little bit shaky. They're very, very nervous in Marseille. I can tell you that.
Okay.
Because they are favourites.
We will round it up on Monday. From the Football League, Barry, interesting news coming out of Wolves, isn't it? That they've been cleared of any George Mendes link.
Yeah.
Or any doing anything wrong.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a surprise, because technically they're not doing anything wrong. I think the main bone of contention was that under FA rules, club owners are forbidden from holding an interest in agencies, and agents are not allowed to have an influence on the running of the club. Fossen International, who own Wolves, also have a stake in Jesty Foot, which is George Mendes's operation, but that stake is not technically owned by Fossen, but by a company owned by its chairman. So, you know, it's kind of a technicality. I think the asterisk over Wolves' title win has always been a moral asterisk. And, you know, show me a club in the Premier League or Championship. There's no shortage of clubs with asterisks beside their name, so why pick on Wolves?
Because they won, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, no one complained about Blackburn and their connection with Jerome Anderson when they were sinking down the divisions. You know, no, everyone was quite happy for it to continue. And the thing I find most amusing is that the main person complaining about Wolves and taking the moral high ground is the chairman of a club who is currently defending that club's decision to go on a tour to Burma.
Yeah. Leeds owner Andrea Radrizzani said the decision on a post-season tour of Myanmar was carefully considered. Leeds are scheduled to play fixtures on the 9th and 11th of May, where families have fled their homes because of what the UN is saying, some ethnic cleansing there. Shadow sports minister.
You say families, 700,000 people.
Yep.
Yes, it's a big family. Yeah, I mean, the shadow sports minister, Dr. Rosina Alin Khan, called the trip morally corrupt. Radrizzani said he believes the trip can have a positive impact on the local community.
Yes,
it's sort of staggering. I mean, it's beyond belief.
Leeds United is actually now in a position where they're close to have the full house, because there's also, I mean, their links to Qatar are very well known. Many links to Qatar, and also one of the most extraordinary things that was pointed out to me by a Leeds fan is that Leeds United TV can be watched in North Korea. Which is an absolutely magnificent detail.
How is that? That is amazing.
That is absolutely amazing. And I'm not making this up. This is actually from leedsunited.com. Stream available in a number of territories, a game against Aston Villa. And again, among those territories is North Korea. And, of course, Myanmar is there too. So they seem to have a line in dictatorships.
Do we know what other things you can watch in North Korea? I mean, is this sort of literally you can only get... Is that the only TV channel you can get apart from the state broadcaster? You've got 1, 2, 3, 4 state broadcaster, and then Leeds United TV. It's this weird thing you flick on and just see Tony Yeboah smashing one in on a rerun. Lee Chapman lifting the league title. Who knows? No one really knows what happens in North Korea. There's huge swathes of Leeds United fans there.
Yeah.
On the pitch in the Championship, Derby scored 3 goals in 21 minutes to stun second place Cardiff on Tuesday. Some real mistakes from Cardiff at the end there. They were 1-0 up thanks to Callum Patterson. 2 goals from Cameron Jerome against his former club. And Matej Vidra. Vidra translates as Otter, by the way. Mr. Otter made it 3-1. Derby move up to 6th. They needed that win because they're on a poor run of form. Cardiff just 1 point clear of Fulham, who play Sunderland on Friday night. So still in Cardiff's hands. They go to Hull on Saturday. 4th place Villa, 4 points off the automatic spots. They host Derby. 5th v 7th as Middlesbrough play Millwall. 3 points separate them. That could have a huge ramification for the teams, for the chasing teams in the race for the playoff places. It's 5th v 7th as Middlesbrough meet Millwall. 3 points separate them. At the other end of the table, Barnsley lost 3-0 at Nottingham Forest on Tuesday, so they're level on points with Burton on 38. Burton play Bolton on Saturday, who are 2 points above them. That is a 6-pointer. Birmingham Reading could still be dragged into the bottom three. They have 43 points. Birmingham go to QPR. Reading host Ipswich. League One, congratulations to Blackburn, and Tony Mowbray's done an absolutely brilliant job at Ewood Park. They won 1-0 at Doncaster just under a year after they became the first ever Premier League winners to be relegated to the third tier. Tony Mowbray said, "I got a lot of texts when I took this job from a lot of very experienced people saying I was a glutton for punishment." They lost their first 2 games of the season as well. Lots of panic, but they've been on a great run. That means Shrewsbury in the playoffs alongside Rotherham. The other place is probably between Charlton, Scunthorpe and Plymouth. Portsmouth have an outside chance. Abbo writes, "I have a question." Oh, sorry, Philippe.
No, just you mentioned Shrewsbury. Perhaps to mention as well, there's a petition going on, and I think Shrewsbury have been very active in that, to at least have safe standing debated in Parliament. And I think they're just a couple of thousand signatures away from getting the 100,000, which will mean that members of the House will have to discuss this proposal.
Mm. Also, Charlton fans will be happy to know there's news coming out of Australia that their club could at any minute be taken over by an Australian consortium, which I think may include cricket's Steve Waugh. Oh, that's what I was told when I was there.
Steve Waugh, Lou Carpenter and Alf Stewart.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine Charlton fans would prefer them to the current regime.
Although, really good fun name to say in a Jim White voice. Roland de Châtelet. into League Two, Abbo says, please don't mention Chesterfield's relegation. It's heartbreaking.
You've just done it, eh?
Well, Morecambe drew 0-0 with Cambridge, which means an unnamed team with a spiry chapel and not a lot else have been relegated. Morecambe could still go down. Very unlikely, though. They're on the same points as Grimsby, who are both 5 points clear of Barnet with two games left. And that will do...
Sorry, Chesterfield have gone out of the league, are they?
I can't mention it. I've been told not to mention it. But yes...
Because I remember they should. I remember not too long ago, the great Kevin Davies playing for them. They should have got to the cup final.
They should have.
They were robbed
by Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
God. When you say not too long ago,
it was quite a long time.
Bloody long time ago. Yeah. Anyway, Chesterfield are neither in the FA Cup final nor are they in the Football League. But I didn't tell you.
What was it? 91?
No, it was after 91.
96.
I'm going to say.
Well, it was just at the start of Kevin Davies' career, and he's. Must be pushing 40, so...
Well, they had one that crossed the line, didn't they, against Middlesbrough? But
yeah, they were 2-0 up and had one off the bar, crossed the line and just wasn't given.
And then it went to extra time and then they got a last-minute one. Did they draw 3-3?
They were absolutely robbed.
Yeah, that was a great game. Anyway, that'll do for part two. But which year was it? You'll find out after the break. Welcome back. This is part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. It was barely yesterday, Barry, that Chesterfield were in the FA Cup semi-final.
I've just discovered it's over 20 years ago.
It's over 20 years ago.
A game I remember more vividly than games I've seen like last week. I don't know why it made such an impression on me.
Yeah, Sean Dyche, I think, scored a penalty, I think, for Chesterfield in that game.
A lot of Culver House gold.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, I'm using Mikel Beck on Sunday. That's for sure. Let's start part three, Philippe, with a very brief... you've tried to do this in our previous pod, but you went on for so long we edited it all out.
I'm sorry.
FIFA 2026.
Mm-hmm.
US, we're in line to get it. Now Morocco might. Infantino is sweating.
Yes, he has a very sweaty, clammy hands at the moment. And he's actually running out of options to torpedo the Moroccan bid. And the Moroccan bid is getting more and more traction as the days and the weeks go past. And the vote is on the 13th of June. Right. And all the little tricks they've tried have failed so far. And they tried one yesterday, which was hilarious, which has to do with the Secretary General of FIFA, Fatma Samoura, who has been reported to the Ethics Committee of FIFA for having failed to declare a conflict of interest, which had to do with Morocco 2026. Now, you're going to ask me, what was this conflict of interest?
What was the conflict of interest?
Well, I will tell you. Apparently, they said that she was related to one of the ambassadors of Morocco 2026 because her real name is Fatma Diouf Samoura, and there is a guy who is banging the drum for Morocco who is called El Hadj Diouf, one of Baz's great friends. And so somebody within the task force of FIFA, with Gianni Infantino's knowledge, of course, reported that, saying they must be related, without doing any research.
Are they related?
Of course not. I mean, being called Diouf in Senegal, or Diallo, or Touré, is a bit like being called Smith, or Perkins, or Müller in Germany, or Dupont in France. So they are not related at all. And apparently they'd overheard the two of them, El Hadj and Fatma, talking to each other as brother and sister, and anybody would know that Africans tend to do that. But so this is the absolutely ridiculous. It shows in the kind of pickle that Infantino is finding himself, because if it doesn't go to the US, he's in real trouble.
Why is he in trouble?
Because he was elected to the post of president of FIFA with the help of the Americans, of Sunil Gulati, and basically promising you'll get 2026. And if he doesn't get that, he's going to be in real, real trouble. Next presidential elections, 2019 for FIFA.
I'm struggling to imagine El Hadj Diouf as an ambassador for anything.
it's what's so fascinating is, I don't know, did everyone give Infantino just a bit of a an easy ride because he's not Sepp Blatter.
He's had an absolutely unbelievably easy ride. He's done things that Sepp Blatter would never have got away with. He's sacked people left, right and centre within FIFA. He's basically got rid of any system of checks and balances. He behaves like a dictator. He's ruining the football. He's ruining football. He's ruining the world game with proposal after proposal.
He's bringing in this Club World Cup thing, isn't it? Have you heard of this Club World Cup thing?
Yeah, $25 billion.
12 teams, 12 European teams. I'm not sure else. It's sort of an extension of the World Club Championship.
No, but they're desperate for money because there's a huge gaping hole, which has made even bigger by the fact that the Russian World Cup is going to be a financial disaster. So
I thought FIFA were absolutely rolling in cash. Where's it all gone?
Where could it have gone?
Well, yeah.
I wonder. And the thing is that FIFA entirely depends upon the World Cup for its financing. It's 95% basically of the money comes through the World Cup and the World Cup alone. And they've already... they've done a bit of, like Leeds, you remember, who mortgaged their TV rights at one point?
What, to North Korea?
And there was an agreement which has already been reached for the TV rights sold to the Americans for a pittance, basically, so that they would keep quiet. That was done by Jerome Valcke. So there is a big gaping hole in FIFA finances. There's been for a while.
If a great man,
and he's promising
woman,
more money to FAs, by the way, because it's bribery, basically.
If a great man or woman came in as head of FIFA, a morally wonderful human being,
mm-hmm.
could they make it right?
I doubt it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, possibly, but it would be already a major improvement. But
it would be like trying to clean out the Aegean stables, wouldn't it?
So we need Hercules.
Yeah.
Hercules for president. And the problem is that it's the whole organization. It's corrupt, and it still is. Corruption is not just about money. It's also about influence and nepotism and things like that. But the confederations have got the same problem. But Infantino is probably the worst possible man we could have had in the current situation.
Yeah. But listen, I only got my job because my dad is Willie Rushton, and you know, from through the keyhole back in the day. That's how I
got mine, because my dad is Raymond Glendening, the Absolutely. Famous racing commentator, yeah. sports commentator. Mm.
Paolo?
I haven't got one. I haven't got one that I can throw out like that.
Philippe only got his job because his dad invented the chocolate au clair.
Right. Premier League fixtures. This week, Liverpool play Stoke. Stoke second bottom, 29 points, desperate for something. I guess Liverpool might rest some players, mightn't they? Whether that'll be enough. This feeling that Paul Lambert's been a bit unlucky, but I don't know how long I can...
I used to think that, and now I'm not buying it anymore.
Yeah, I remember you saying that about 2 weeks ago. And
I think I said on Monday they've thrown away 10 points from winning positions in 12 league games under Lambert, and I think that goes beyond bad luck. It's just poor game management.
He hasn't
or it might be a witch's curse.
Right. He hasn't lost at Anfield. 3 wins and 2 draws. That's definitely a witch's curse he's put on Anfield. Burnley, Brighton. A win for Brighton would guarantee his side's Premier League status.
They'd better win this one, because what follows is pretty nasty.
Mm. Well, it'd be a great achievement for them, wouldn't it? Palace, mm-hmm. Leicester.
Just looking I had to do a thing for Friday, and there's, I think it's 4 Burnley players all played for Brighton in the lower leagues, and 8 of Brighton's last starting 11 played for them in the championships last season. So it's sort of a example of how you don't need to throw gazillions of pounds at things teams to keep them in the Premier League. Good coaching can help.
Newcastle, West Brom. If West Brom don't win, they'll be relegated. But Darren Moore's done enough to get the job, do you reckon?
Well, what else could he have done?
I think he's done enough. I don't think he'll get it.
Yeah, that's what I think.
But might somebody else actually notice the fact that he's done a really great job?
I would hope so, yeah. I mean, so
you'd say whoever's the next person who gives Alan Pardew a job should just give it to Darren Moore, perhaps. Southampton, Bournemouth. Southampton 4 points off safety. Winless in 8 Premier League matches. Have not won any of their last 9 at St Mary's. Or people saying, why they got rid of Claude Puel. You know, of a team to shot themselves in the foot, not quite as much as Birmingham getting rid of Gary Rowett, yeah. But what Southampton did last year and your expectation as a club,
yep.
Silly.
Yep.
You've been silly. There you are. Swansea played Chelsea. Swansea fourth bottom. On Sunday, West Ham v Man City. Andy says, do City need to be proactive or reactive in the transfer market this summer? Everyone else will strengthen to catch up, as always, and will be difficult to retain the title, as always. Do they try and strengthen before everyone else or wait to see what everyone else does? Clearly proactive.
It's always weird in the World Cup summer, isn't it? You either have to get your business done very, very quickly or you're waiting until after the tournament because no one's around to sign things. So, yeah, I don't think many people outside of Manchester City fans are probably worrying too much about poor Manchester City and how they'll handle this summer.
I think you're right.
This and I also their targets don't... already. They have already got their targets. I mean, there's loads of talk about Julian Weigl, for example. They know where they need reinforcements. That's not. I mean, Guardiola has been very clear about it. He said basically maybe a couple of players, but more or less the squad is there. It's a very young squad, so let's carry on with the same guys.
I also don't think it'll be hard for them to retain their title.
No, I don't either. But what will be interesting after the World Cup is to see which players Premier League clubs spend a lot of money on because they score one really good goal in the first elimination in the, you know, the round of 16.
I mean, it will have an impact. It depends how well the better your players perform at the World Cup, the worse is going to be for you because they're going to be knackered until about October. So that's the only thing that might... plead against Manchester City.
Manchester United play Arsenal, Paolo.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in many ways for a Man United Arsenal, it feels almost a bit defanged, a bit sort of like a dead rubber because Arsenal have got their biggest game, as we've already talked about, coming up on Thursday, the one that's going to define their season probably at this point, certainly that tie. And United haven't got an awful lot left to play for other than finishing ahead of Liverpool. But it's still Man United Arsenal. It's still a big game, and I don't doubt that Jose will want his last, potentially his last ever chance to stick the boot into Wenger. In fact, that alone will be fascinating. Will Mourinho, after all this time needling Wenger and enjoy it, will he try and be sort of chummy with him? And
he's going to be chummy in the 85th minute, isn't he? He's going to go and sit next to Arsene in the dugout and 2 minutes left.
I'm hoping. I don't think that would work with Wenger. I wouldn't do that if I were Mourinho. I wouldn't sit next to Arsene in the 85th minute unless Arsene is winning 5-0.
Oh, I hope he does. Yeah.
Wenger reprises that, you know, Christ on the cross, arms outstretched behind the dugout.
Spurs play Watford on Monday night. Celtic play Rangers on Sunday where they can clinch the title. Steven Gerrard trending today, Barry. He's been made odds-on favourite to become the next Rangers manager after the chairman, Dave King, was spotted at the Liverpool's Champions League semi-final against Roma.
Dave King is a Liverpool fan who regularly goes to Anfield, so anyone... who reads too much into the fact that he was caught on TV would celebrating a goal and has invested money on Steven Gerrard becoming next Rangers manager on the back of it, I'd say has done their money.
Oh. Serie A, Paolo.
Yeah, a huge weekend now because of what happened last weekend. We have the Derby d'Italia on Saturday night, Inter against Juventus. And obviously Juventus now have no margin for error left. They're only 1 point ahead of Napoli. If they drop points here, then Napoli will have the chance to go top against when they play Fiorentina a day later. And of course, it's escaped no one's attention. While Fiorentina are a good team, ninth in the table, not easy to beat, still just about fighting for a Europa League place, it's not escaped anyone's attention that Fiorentina absolutely despise Juventus. So whether or not this is a good time for Napoli to be travelling there, talk of a huge number of Napoli fans going to this game as well. Who knows? But of course, it all starts with Inter against Juventus. And Inter, besides themselves hating Juventus, are fifth at the moment, 1 point off the top four places, desperately fighting to get back in the Champions League. So they are going to be not short of motivation on Saturday night.
Mm. All right. Let's finish with two sensational bits of Jonathan Wilson news. Part one, he tweeted, "You're not going to believe this. The Guardian have commissioned him to write about his silent witness database."
It's a wall chart, isn't it?
I think it's a spreadsheet. I'm not entirely sure.
Okay.
I think we created the fact it's on his wall with a series of strings attached to each other. And the other bit of Jonathan Wilson news is he sent a tweet this week.
Amazing, yes.
Just got attacked by a crow. 7 kilometres into an 11 kilometre run, sapped by the undulating cliffs, halfway up the 200-foot climb, past the Marsden Inn to the riding school, and I had to duck sprint to take cover in a bus shelter, leaving me with a scratched scalp, bruised back, and diminished dignity.
I would never have imagined Wilson reprising Tippi Hedren's role in The Bird, but that's almost exactly the same scene, isn't it?
I didn't realise Crowes did that. I mean,
what could they have mistaken Jonathan for? I think
maybe it had red inverted in the pyramid.
Yeah. Or, I mean, could someone have put a curse on,
on Jonathan Wilson? I can only assume he'd gone a bit too close to a nest with eggs in it or something, but
he'd been a bit too dour about football and the crow had got angry.
This crow just simply doesn't think that goals are overrated.
What we can definitely take from this is why Twitter expanded to 280 characters for stories like this.
For all the ills of social media, it gave us...
What I loved about that was John Cross replied and asked, oh, did you get it on video? Obviously a joke. And Mr. Curmudgeon goes, you know what I look like, you know what a crow looks like, and you know what a hill looks like. Just imagine it in your head. Bah, humbug.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Barry, for your time.
You're welcome.
Paolo, thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you, Philly.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.